From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
This was the most political I had ever been in my life, and I was very supportive of a particular candidate. So I would either be at the inauguration happy and celebrating or throwing a shoe at Sarah Palin.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have three stories about serving, giving, and the greater community. Values WBHM knows all about.
I worked for a group called AmeriCorps. You signed up for it and you did 1,500 hours of service or whatever for a stipend that you could then use to pay your student loans. What this meant was that you lived below the poverty level for 10 months.
We created ARC Stories with WBHM to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So, coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have three stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include a father who wants to give away all of his children's Christmas presents and a guy trying to get into the presidential inauguration without a ticket.
In our first story, one young man commits himself to giving back to his community by serving the less fortunate. However, in this case, the less fortunate also turn out to be the less grateful. From an event we hosted at the Avon Theater where our theme was Down on Your Luck, Stories for Friday the 13th. Here's storyteller Leonard Lee Smith.
I worked for a group called AmeriCorps in 1996, and I want to tell you about the day I became officially known as an SOB. AmeriCorps was signed into legislation by President Clinton, and it was the Domestic Peace Corps. And you signed up for it, and you did 15,000 hours or 1,500 hours of service or whatever it seemed like, 15,000, for a stipend that you could then use to pay your student loans. What this meant was that you lived below the poverty level for 10 months. The program I worked for was here in Birmingham with Birmingham AIDS Outreach. We were trained to be in-home health aides to provide health care for persons living with HIV. Now, the AIDS epidemic had been around for about 10 years, but there was still a lot of stigma with it. And we tried to give our clients as much dignity as possible. They got to choose who provided them with service. They got to set a lot of parameters about how things were done. I had a lot of misconceptions about helping indigent and poor people that I had gotten from a lot of old black and white movies on Turner Classic Movies. So I was not prepared for dealing with people who had mental illness and addiction issues, and it was a real reality adjustment. But I did my 3 months of training, and I learned how to change an occupied bed and give baths and prepare food and work with nurses, and all of that training has come in handy ever since then. I can still change an occupied bed for a sick person. And I've had to do that more than I would ever thought I had would have to with elderly family members. So I was all gung-ho to start my service. I'd had my 3 months of training, and the 26-year-old Volkswagen Beetle convertible that I was using for transportation that I had planned to restore one day quit working, and my mechanic informed me that it would take about $10,000 to refurbish it, and it wasn't really refurbishable, and if I did that, I would have to replace the floorboard because the seat was about to fall out, and if I could get it running, it would run me over. So this meant that I was going to be doing my service from a bicycle. I went out and bought a bicycle, and I knew this was possible because one of my other AmeriCorps coworkers had done this. But I bought this bicycle in early October when the weather is lovely, and you think, oh, this is doable. By now it was November, and you know how the weather's getting cold now? There are a lot of things about living life off of a bicycle I was not prepared for. You have to carry inner tubes with you. You have to know how to change a tire in any kind of weather. You have to carry everything that you would ever need in a backpack, and it gets heavier and heavier the colder the weather gets. I had taken a part-time job working at a restaurant three nights a week to supplement my income, which meant a lot of times I would go almost 24 hours without sleep. I was at the AmeriCorps office one day, and I only had to get till noon. I was on call, and if I got to noon and no one called in for service, I got to go home and go to sleep, and I had been up for almost 24 hours. And it was pretty close to noon, and the secretary came out, and she said, "Are you available to provide service?" I said, "Yes, I'm the on-call person." She said, "Good, I need you to go to Jay's house and provide service." I said, "There's a problem there. I know who Jay is, but I can't provide service because one of Jay's restrictions is he doesn't want any gay men providing service." And she's like, "Well, you're the only person available, so he'll have to adapt. Here's the address." Now, this was in the days before GPS, so you had to go into the office to a giant wall map that had pins in it and figure out where the person lived. I figured out where Jay lived. I got on my bicycle in the cold weather, and I rode over. Our clients got lunch service from Grace Episcopal Church, and the little clamshell with his lunch was still sitting outside the door. So I picked it up and knocked on the door, and from inside, this person started hollering, "Go away, I'm sleeping, I don't want anybody here." Finally, the door was snatched open, and there stood this very tiny, angry, hungover little black man. And he said, "Who are you?" I said, "James, I'm with AmeriCorps. I'm here to provide you service." He's like, "Where are the people that normally come?" I said, "I don't know. Something has happened. I'm here to provide you with service." And then came the fatal question, "Are you a sissy?" I chose to ignore this question because I couldn't come up with a good answer. I mean, I've been out for a while, and I was okay with that, but if I answered in the affirmative, where was this going to go? And if I answered, so I just chose to ignore it. I said, "I have your lunch here." He said, "You're ignoring my question. Are you a sissy?" I said, "James, I don't think that's a very polite question to ask anyone." He goes, "Well, you ain't denying it, so you must be." I decided at this point I was here to do a job, and unless he asked me to leave, I was going to do it. I said, "What do you want me to do with your lunch?" He said, "I don't eat those things. Put it in the fridge." So I walk into his apartment and open up his refrigerator and discover the nightmare that is his refrigerator. He did not eat these lunches. He literally opened up the refrigerator door and threw them into the refrigerator. There was a collection of crumpled styrofoam clamshells, and the refrigerator was covered with splattered food. I said, "James, your refrigerator is a horror." He said, "If you don't like it, stay out of it. It's my refrigerator." I said, "I'm going to make you coffee, and I'm going to clean your refrigerator." So I made coffee and set him down at the table with his little hungover self to drink coffee and proceeded to clean the refrigerator, which took quite a while. Then came the real work. My agenda was I had to give this man a bath, I had to change the bed linens, I had to get him fed, I had to do his laundry, and I had to get him to take his medication. In those days, the only medications were AZT. It was a really horrible medication with a lot of side effects. It was a lot of pills. It was just a disaster. Most people didn't want to take it. So we had conflicting agendas. The only reason that James allowed AmeriCorps to come provide him service was the way he dealt with his situation was by being mean and drinking very heavily, and he couldn't get to the package store on his own. So he always wanted one of us to take him to the package store. Now, I found out later that many of the AmeriCorps volunteers did this, even though because it was against the rules, because it was the lesser of the evils. If we didn't take him, he got someone in his apartment complex to go for him. But they were robbing him. He didn't know how much money they were taking out of his wallet, and he was opening his door to strangers. Plus, it got him out of the house. So he said, "I need you to take me to the package store." I said, "James, that's not going to happen. It's against the rules, and besides, I'm on a bicycle." He said, "A bicycle? A bicycle? You ain't got a car?" I said, "No, James, I don't." He said, "They sent me a sissy on a bicycle?" I said, "Yes, they did, James, and you have to get a bath." He said, "Uh-uh, I ain't going in the bathroom with you." I said, "James, you have to have a bath." Mm-mm. So after much negotiation, it was decided I would go into the bathroom, draw him a bath, set out a towel, and clean clothes. I did this. He went into the bathroom. I said, "James, whatever you do, don't lock the door." He immediately locked the door. It sounded like he was wrestling a rhino in there. There were all these noises coming. It was obvious he was falling. I said, James, if you fall and injure yourself or kill yourself in the bathroom on my shift, I will be in trouble. That's your problem. I'm taking a bath. So once I realized he was finally in the bathtub, I figured he would not drown, and I proceeded to change the bed linens. But I noticed that there were no bed linens in the bedroom, and that the bed, although it was practically new, had no sheets on it. And I said, James, where are the bed linens? I need to put your sheets down. He's like, I don't sleep on the bed. I'm like, what? So a while later, he emerged from the bathroom, bathed with his pajama bottoms on backward. He looked comfortable. I wasn't going to say anything about it. I said, James, we have to get your bed made up. He said, I don't sleep on the bed. I sleep on the couch. I realized later on that the reason for this is that when he would wake up inebriated or after been drinking heavily, the couch had only one orientation. When you sat up, the coffee table was in front of you, the kitchen was to the left, the bathroom was to the right. In the bedroom, he would get lost, and he had had no training on how to live as a blind person, and he would run into the walls. So I made up the bed and got him comfortable on the couch, and I said, what do you want to eat? I brought your clamshell of lunch in. And he said, no, I don't eat any of that food. And I noticed that his freezer was full of all of the delicacies of Southern soul food. Pig ears, gizzards, all of that kind of stuff. I said, James, you have all this food in the freezer. Who brings it over? He said, my sister brings it, but she won't cook in my kitchen. She's afraid if she cooks at my house, she'll get sick. I told her I'm blind, I can't cook it, but she brings it anyway. Well, fortunately, I learned to cook from my mother and grandmothers, who were country people, and did not shy away from any part of the pig or the chicken, and I knew how to prepare this food. So I set about making him lunch. I found a package of neck bones. I boiled them to make gravy. I made buttered rice. I found a packet of collards that were frozen and a can of black-eyed peas, and I proceeded to make him lunch. He kept commenting that I was making way too much noise and it was hard to sleep, but that I did have the place smelling pretty good. So as I was close to getting to lunchtime, I said, okay, James, this is what I have for you. And he said, I never will forget, if it's neck bones, I need mustard. And if there's greens, I need pepper sauce. And it occurred to me, those were the condiments I had thrown out in the trash when I had cleaned out the refrigerator. And I said, you won't eat it without that? Mm-mm. So I made a decision. I turned everything on the stove down on low. I got on my bicycle. I rode the 6 blocks to the Stop and Rob store on Southside. I bought a thing of mustard, a thing of pepper salt. I rushed back thinking, please don't let the apartment be on fire when I get back. I served up a plate of food. I put it on the table. I brought him to the table, and to my great delight, he ate with gusto. And when he was done, he asked for seconds on the neck bones and the rice. So I had gotten him to eat, and he was willing to take his meds. And I gave him his meds, and I got him set up. And as I was getting ready to go, I never will forget what he said. I said, James, you're set up. There will be someone here tomorrow at noon to provide you with service. Do you have everything you need? He said he did. And as I was walking out the door, he said, by the way, I know you're white by the way you talk, but the way you cook, somebody in your family lied because somebody in your woodpile is dark. I said, maybe so, James, maybe so. I went home and collapsed in bed after having worked more than 24 hours. Got up the next morning, went into the AmeriCorps office, and I was greeted by one of the directors who told me that they had called that morning to check on James, and that he had talked about me and my cooking, and that I had moved from being an unwanted person to being put on his preferred caregiver list. He never learned my name correctly. I was Lester, Lawn, Lynn, any number of things. But most often, I was the sissy on the bicycle. Two things happened from that. I became known as the SOB. And despite the AmeriCorps rules, I never arrived on my bicycle without a bottle of Wild Irish Rose in my backpack.
I'm gonna need someone to help me. I'm gonna need somebody's pain.
Leonard Lee Smith is a hairdresser by trade, but he can be found telling stories at various venues all around Alabama. Find him at his website, llsmithstoryteller.com.
Now, if you thought Jay was initially less than thrilled with the idea of Leonard Lee helping him out, just wait until you hear the reactions of our next storyteller's children when he tries to convince them they should give up all of their presents for Christmas. That's coming up on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own True Stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, Story Coach with ARC Stories. Now, whenever the holiday season rolls around, we like to think of it as a time of giving and gratitude. But that's often not reality, especially when we consider kids who are completely zeroed in on what presents they're getting. In this next story, one dad tries to do something about that attitude. This is from an event we hosted this past holiday season at the Avon Theater. Our theme was, "Tis the Season, Stories About the Holidays." Here's storyteller Jeremy Gore.
I love Christmas. I love getting presents. I love giving presents. I love buying presents for my kids. I have three boys with very unique personalities. My oldest son, Zach, likes camping. And my middle son, Caleb, likes football and wrestling. My youngest son, Joshua, likes parkour and rock climbing. So each one has their own specific personality, and I love picking a gift that matches their personality. And I love seeing their face whenever they open the present that I spent a long time picking out. And it's just, I just love everything about Christmas. And a few years ago, I had to deal with something that no parent should have to deal with on Christmas morning: bad attitudes. We would have conversations like, "What's wrong, buddy?"
"Well, I don't like this Power Ranger."
"Why not, man? You add that on your Christmas list."
"Well, I wanted the yellow Power Ranger."
"Oh, come on. Just be happy with the Power Ranger you got."
"Okay."
And so I thought, you know what? I want to do something about this. I want to take care of this situation with the bad attitudes. And I want better attitudes on Christmas morning. And so throughout the year, I thought, what can I do, you know, to change the situation on Christmas morning? I was talking to my friend about it, and he said, "Wow, you know what? I know four kids who are probably not going to have any presents on Christmas morning. Their parents are in jail. They're staying with their grandmother. And I'm trying to find someone that will, like, actually give presents to these kids." And then I had an idea. I was like, what if I can convince my kids to give their presents to these four kids? And the more I thought about it, I was like, that might solve our bad attitude situation on Christmas morning. And I talked to my wife, and she goes, no. I said, come on, I'm serious here. She goes, "Jeremy, you are gonna ruin their Christmas. Who does that to their kids?" And she goes, "Besides, they wait all year long for Christmas because they don't really get a lot of presents during the year. They don't get a lot of toys during the year." And she brought up something that I hadn't really thought about. Long time ago, what we decided to do with our kids was, if they wanted a toy, then we would say, "Well, maybe for your birthday or maybe for Christmas." And we would wait until their birthday or Christmas to give them that present. And so she made me realize, maybe not. That might not be a good idea. And I said, I still want to do something, and I couldn't figure it out. And time was going by, and my kids were getting nervous because they know that I like to do creative things to teach life lessons. And they were worried that I was teaching a life lesson this year because there is no Christmas presents under the Christmas tree. And they would drop hints like, "Dad, you should see the number of presents under our neighbor's tree." And I'd be like, "Oh, that's awesome, man. They're going to have a great Christmas." That didn't help. And so time kept going by, and I couldn't make up my mind. And it was getting closer to Christmas. And finally, I just had to, like, make a decision. And the Saturday before Christmas, I said, okay, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to go for broke. I'm going to try to get my kids to give their presents away. And they may hate me and talk about me to their psychiatrist in 30 years. It may change their life forever. I don't know, but you know what? I'm just going to try it. And so I brought everyone into the living room. I said, family meeting. Come on, guys. I'm going to tell you why you don't have any Christmas presents under the tree. And you know what? I'm going to explain everything, and I think you're really going to like it. And as they're all walking into the living room, then my wife is walking into the living room with them, and her chin is kind of like up in the air, and her eyes are squinty, like, what is this plan that you have? And that's when I realized I forgot to tell my wife. And I start stumbling, thinking, how am I going to get out of this? And I'm just building it up even more. I'm like, oh, hey, this is going to be great. You guys are going to love this. It's not like anything you've ever done before. And I'm thinking, how do I get out of this? And I couldn't do it, so I just blurted it. I'm like, okay, this year's going to be different. Here's what we're going to do. You guys are going to pick out your own Christmas presents. And my 14-year-old was the first to respond. He said, Dad, what are you talking about? And I said, okay, let me break it down for you. Here's what we're going to do. We are going to pile in the car. We're going to drive to Walmart, and you are going to pick out your very own Christmas presents. Get everything that's on your list. I'll buy them. We'll come home, wrap them, put them underneath the tree. And then on Christmas morning, you can unwrap these presents, and you have everything that you wanted for Christmas. And they're like, yeah, this is awesome. This is so great. And they said, when can we go? And I said, right now, because I'm not going to give you any time to make that list any longer. And it was not a very far drive to Walmart, but it was a long drive. Because in the back seat, every time we hit a stoplight, someone would go, come on. And my wife, not knowing what's this grand master plan that I have, she reaches over and grabs my hand. She goes, Jeremy, this is a good idea. And I'm thinking, if I can't pull this off, I'm a dead man. And so we pull into the Walmart parking lot, and it's in the middle of the holiday traffic. And I know you've heard this a million times, but it was so fitting in the situation. The air was electric. We pull into the parking spot, and the kids fling open the doors. And I can see it happening before it actually happens. I say, don't run. You guys, no running in the parking lot. We're all walking together. And that walk from the car door to Walmart's front door was excruciatingly painful for these boys. They tried so hard not to run. And at one point, my middle son, Caleb, who was 9 years old at the time, he couldn't take it. He just like broke out into a run. I was like, Caleb, come back here. And so he slowed back down into a semi-controlled walk, and we all made it to the front doors of Walmart. And it's like those glass electric doors slid open for us. My boys walked through like they were kings, and I raised my arms and I said, go buy anything you want. They're like, anything? Like, anything. And they took off. I mean, they knew exactly where to go because they had been like planning on this all year. So like my oldest son, Zach, he went over to the hunting equipment and camo, and my middle son, Caleb, he went over to the footballs, and my youngest son, Josh, went over to the games, and like they were like little mice in a maze, going, getting what they wanted and coming back, putting it in the cart. And I realized that they had gotten everything on their list whenever they started picking out random things. Like they were like, oh, what's this pretty label on the bleach bottle? I'm going to grab that. Like, okay, this is it. We're stopping it. We're going to go home, and we're going to buy it, put it all under the tree after it's wrapped up. And the car ride home was so much fun because they tried to convince me that we didn't need Christmas morning now because they knew exactly what they got. Like, hey, we don't need them. You know, we don't need to open these presents. Let us play with it now. I'm like, no, that's the deal. You've got to wrap them up and put them underneath the tree. And so they were at home wrapping their presents, and I walked in the room, and I was like, hey, guys, you know what's crazy? They're like, huh? Said, I know 4 boys that aren't going to have any Christmas presents this year. What would you think about giving your presents, like these presents, to those 4 boys? And my oldest son, Zach, stood up. He's like, I knew this was too good to be true. He just walks out of the room. M- My youngest son, Joshua, goes, well, Jesus said it's better to give than to receive. And so if they don't have any presents, they can have mine. I think I heard angels singing at that moment. And my middle son, Caleb, was just staring straight ahead, and I was looking for a reaction, and then his bottom lip started to quiver. I was like, oh, no. And he just started crying. And he said, Dad, I don't want to give my presents away. And I'm like, man, you don't have to give your presents away. I said, only do it if you absolutely want to. And he's like, but I'm going to look like a jerk. I'm going to look like a big, selfish jerk. And I'm like, no, you won't, buddy. These are your presents. You don't have to give them away. He said, oh, he sat there and cried for a minute. And he goes, oh, okay, I will. I'm like, no, don't do it. Don't give them away. He goes, no, I want to. I said, okay. So on Christmas Eve, we loaded the presents into the car. And we took some food down to this family and met our good friends, Stephen and Victoria Harriet, there. They brought a Christmas tree and some Christmas ornaments. And we set up the tree, made the ornaments, put the presents underneath the tree, ate and played and laughed and had a great time. And towards the end of the night, I noticed a little boy crawling underneath the tree and peeling back a wrapper from one of the presents. And he was looking, and my son Caleb saw the same thing. And he crawled over there to him, and he whispered something in his ear, and the little boy's eyes got really big, and he just kind of stood back for a second, and Caleb smiled, and they both smiled at each other and ran off and kept playing. And my plan wasn't finished, because the next morning, there was still another twist. I had written down everything that they had given away. I went back to Walmart and bought it all, wrapped it, and put it underneath the tree. So on Christmas morning, they had everything that they wanted for Christmas. And a few years later, they came up to me and they said, hey, Dad, remember that Christmas that you asked us to give our presents away? I'm like, yeah. They said, we just want to thank you, because until that moment, we didn't know the joy that came from giving. And if you ask them, even today, they'll tell you that their favorite Christmas was the Christmas that they gave away.
Jeremy Gore is a project manager at Integrity Management. You can get a glimpse into his world on Instagram at Jeremy Gore.
Not only was that Jeremy's first time to tell a story at one of our events, it was also his first time to attend one of our events. He heard about us right here on WBHM, which means he's just like you, a listener with a great story to tell. And we'd love to hear your stories. Who knows? You could even be featured at one of our live events and even perhaps right here on the radio. You can submit them to us through the story portal on our website, arcstories.com.
Coming up, hear a story not so much about giving, but actually one where our storyteller benefits from the generosity of a stranger in a pretty cool way. That's next on Arc Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson. And I'm not the biggest history buff in the world or anything, but I can't help but hear about certain moments from the past and think it would have been awesome to be there for that moment. Well, our next storyteller is trying to do just that, to simply be present as history is made. This story was recorded at an event we held earlier this year at the Avon Theater. Our theme was So There I Was, Stories That Begin, So There I Was. Here's storyteller Al Elliott.
So there I was, holding the winning lottery ticket. I know, right? So it all started back in mid-October 2008. This was the most political I had ever been in my life, and I was very supportive of a particular candidate, and I happened to be online looking for a good flight. So the flights were very affordable to D.C. that year. Because of my really good feeling, I decided I'll go ahead and take advantage and buy this ticket now, so I would either be at the inauguration happy and celebrating or throwing a shoe at Sarah Palin. So it worked out. It worked out. I was not be telling you the story of me throwing shoes at the person that didn't win. Now, this was a special year, right? And kind of for obvious reasons, and I know there are some people, and I'll admit, there are some people that had a problem with black people supporting Barack Obama at the time just because he was black. I myself was not supporting him because he was black, but if you were one of those persons, right, that took pride in supporting him, and that was the only reason, I totally don't have a problem with it. Like, whatever reason you were supporting him that year, we were on the same team, go team, is how I felt, right? Like, I was super proud that he was just an actual, like, I remember 88 and Jesse Jackson and bless his heart, right? I supported him then because he was black, right? Like, that's why, I'll admit it. But this guy was different. He was actually qualified, a little overqualified, right? So it's like, cool. Right? Like, it's, yeah. So that was the year he actually won. I had my ticket and I was set. Like, this was the moment. So, as fate would have it, it's cheaper to fly out of Atlanta than it is Birmingham. So, I drive over to Atlanta to catch the flight. And I don't fly a lot, right? I am the country mouse, right? So, I don't do that often. So, they were explaining something to me at the ticket counter, this concept of overbooking a flight. Like, I had no idea. Like, I remember buying the flight. I knew that there were enough seats. I picked it out on the actual diagram on the website. And they're telling me this thing, like, well, you know, you might not be able to get on this flight, right? And I am irate, but I'm also conscious that I do not want to be the angry black man in the airport at this time. Because I actually wanted to get on. So I'm upset, but just so, you know, not really. I'm not really mad, but I'm really adamant about getting on the flight. Well, a pilot overhears me. He overhears the conversation. He said, hey, you know what? There's an extra seat in the cockpit. Listen to me. There's an extra seat in the cockpit so I can fly up front and you can give that slightly disgruntled gentleman my seat. Who knew pilots flew first class? I didn't. So I'm going to have a first class ticket on the way to the inauguration. Everything seems to be working out, right? Like, whoa, I don't even believe it. So I show up at the airport in D.C. My friends are waiting there. It just so happened earlier that year, a friend of mine that is a school teacher, still today, had just moved to D.C. So I had a place to stay. A lot of her friends had a place to stay. She had a lot of friends that year. Her apartment was like a hostel, really. It was just people in there, right? So we all get up here. As soon as I get there, I'm whisked away to this party. Again, I'm the country mouse, so I didn't exactly understand the conversation over to the party. They were talking about hookers. They're really hookahs, right? So I was like, is it okay? That's legal now? I didn't know we were going to a party. But anyway, there were all sorts of things going on. We're having a wonderful time. And so then it starts to get a little serious, right? Because at the actual inauguration at the National Mall, there's a side that's free where anybody can get in if you can get in. And there's a side where you have to have a ticket, right? Exactly. See? So I just really wanted to be there. Right? Like, they had jumbotrons out there, there isn't a bad seat. So if I can just say, I was there, cool, right? I was there. So I'm asking for directions. I talk to the police. They say, hey, yeah, this is the free side. This is where they're letting people in. So I go in, I huddle in. There are thousands of people there. The night before when we was planning it out, when we figured out that we would have to get out there really early, like catch the metro at 2 in the morning, nobody else wanted to get up at 2 in the morning and go. So I went out there by myself. Well, not really, because there were thousands of people out there. So we were just out there huddled in, waiting to get in, singing Christmas carols. It was wonderful. The sun finally came up, and we started working our way in, right? And we're just excited. We're happy. We can't believe it. You're here. I'm here. Everybody's there. And little by little, I'm noticing people weaving their way through the crowd, coming out. That's odd. It's a weird time to have to use the bathroom. Certainly they have porter potties on the other side of the gate, I'm thinking. Well, finally someone gets close enough to me, and the look on his face was just so curious, I was forced to ask a question. Why are you walking in this direction? And he tells me, hey, up at the front, if you don't have a ticket, they're not letting you in this way. That's weird. I asked about that. Like, this is the wrong line, and it was the wrong line. So now I have that look on my face, and I'm weaving out of the crowd, but I'm lost. It's about 45 minutes before showtime. I don't have enough time to catch the metro to go back. I don't have anywhere else to actually watch the inauguration. And I think this is before Sprint updated their network, so the phone's not working with everybody else trying to call, I guess. So I'm just stuck. So I'm walking around, my face is long, and this guy, I'll never forget his name. I think we're like soulmates. Devin Parikh. He comes up to me and he says, "Why are you walking that way?" The same question I asked when I had that look on my face. And I said, "Listen, if you don't have a ticket, they're not letting anybody in that way. So I don't know what to tell you." He says, "You don't have a ticket? Well, you do now. You're coming with us." And he holds up this cartoon-looking shaped golden ticket, right? I am instantly upset because I know this is like the worst joke ever. Like, I'm about to kill a perfect stranger for playing this practical joke on camera somewhere. But he was like, "Actually, someone in our party got sick this morning, and we were just looking for somebody by themselves to give it to." I'm by myself. No one wanted to come out with me. So now we're all happy. We're making our way. I am actually surprised at how impressive this yellow ticket is. We're getting past gates. They're lifting over ropes. There's someone with like this crazy hairstyle standing in front of me, turns around, holds up two fingers and says, "Only in America, baby." Like, this is the section I'm in. It's Don King type seats. He doesn't have a bad seat for anything, right? So that's how close we are. So we get in. I witness history, and it's wonderful. A couple of days later, it's time to come back to reality. Everything was wonderful. So I had to, while I was still in Atlanta, on the way home, buy a lottery ticket. And so I do. And I get home, and I start thinking about how serendipitously this trip had come together. I had bought a ticket before the actual election, and it worked. Right? I didn't have a ticket and ended up getting one. So surely, it must be the time to buy a lottery ticket. When I start thinking about it, I really didn't think that I could take actually realizing that I didn't win. So I never actually checked the tickets because I had already won. That's my story.
Al Elliott is a father, an educator, and currently works as a language arts teacher. Learn more about him at his website, elocation.com.
We would love to have you join us to hear more great stories from right here in Birmingham at one of our live events. Our next one is coming up soon on April 23rd at the Avon Theater. You can get all the details and your tickets on our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering is by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon, Nate Dreger, and Jake Brantley for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and you can even submit your own story to tell. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?